In this next hour, we hear from Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan, speaking on H.R. 1, For the People Act of 2019, which calls to expand America's access to the ballot box, reduce the influence of big money in politics, and strengthen ethics rules for public servants and for other purposes. Mark Pocan spoke at the Sequoia Public Library on July 13, 2019. The talk was sponsored by the Madison Institute, the League of Women Voters of Dane County, the American Constitution Society, Common Cause Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. But first, we hear from Fred Wade, president of the Madison Institute, who gives us a history lesson on why the United States has a House of Representatives and a Senate, and why we have state legislatures. Now, Fred Wade.
I think this is a particularly timely program to have Mark Pocan here speaking about the H.R. 1 and the efforts to improve the functioning of our democracy. It's become apparent to me that with many of the issues that we have to confront and which are addressed in the bill, that many of us may not be clear on the concept of why we have the institutions that we do, why we have a House of Representatives in the Congress of the United States, why we have state legislators. So I thought I'd give a little bit of history here as to why we have the institutions that we do as an introduction to Mark's presentation. Many of us probably don't recall, or it's good to be reminded, that the English had three revolutions in the space of 130 years about the issue of self-government and what it requires to make a good law. When the Stuart kings came in England, they claimed that they had a divine right to govern and make laws as they wished. There was pushback from the Parliament. And ultimately, in 1649, King Charles I was deposed and executed. And what was the argument against King Charles? Well, he had tried to impose taxes and require contributions to the royal treasury without common consent by Act of Parliament. And he persisted for over a period of 10 years before he was deposed. And there was an interim government by William Cromwell and the Parliament, governing without a king. The monarchy was restored in 1660. Charles II was more moderate. James II was not. He was deposed in 1649. And again, what was the issue? The English passed a Bill of Rights in 1689 that said to justify the deposition. And he said, James II did subvert the laws and liberties of the kingdom by assuming a power of suspending laws, and I'm editing a bit as I read, without consent of Parliament, and by levying money for use of the crown by pretense of prerogative that Parliament did not grant. And since that time, there's a coronation oath when they brought in William and Mary to govern as king and queen. It requires the kings and queens to promise that they shall govern, quote, according to the statutes in Parliament agreed on. About 1765, on the eve of the American Revolution, William Blackstone wrote commentaries on the law of England, which were an authoritative statement of the law of England that governed for about 50 years. Abraham Lincoln began his study of law by picking up a copy of William Blackstone's commentaries. And among other things, he said, Parliament consists of the Crown, the House of Lords, and the House of Commons. And the consent of all three is required to make any new law that shall bind the subject. He said, the law must perpetually stand as it does now unless all three of those powers will agree to alter it. Whatever is enacted for law by one or by two only of the three is no statute, and to it no regard is due. And he says the premise, at least with respect to the role of the House of Commons, is that every man is supposed a free agent, and therefore a branch at least of the legislative power should reside in the whole body of the people. So that was the understanding of things on the eve of the American Revolution, when Parliament, after the French and Indian War, decided to raise revenue by taxing the American colonists. And the Stamp Act in 1765 caused such a storm, the Parliament was forced to repeal it a year later, but they said in repealing it in the Declaratory Act, Parliament has full authority to make laws and statutes to bind the colonies and people of America in all cases whatsoever. Well, that was the essential constitutional issue over which the American Revolution was fought. In 1774, after additional efforts to tax the colonists, the First Continental Congress said, "The foundation of all English liberty and of all free government is the right in the people to participate in their legislative council. And as they are not represented in the British Parliament, they are entitled to a free and exclusive power of legislation in their several provincial legislatures." And significantly, with the Declaration of Independence, declaring that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, three of the most populous states in the colonies passed declarations of rights, which I think put the concept as clearly as it could be presented. Virginia, Declaration of Rights adopted just days before the Declaration of Independence, says citizens cannot be taxed or deprived of their property for public uses without their own individual consent or that of their representative assembly, nor bound by any law to which they have not in like manner assented for the public good. Pennsylvania followed 3 months later in almost identical language. And Massachusetts in 1780, in their constitution drafted by John Adams, said no part of the property of any individual can be taken from him or applied to public uses without his own consent or that of the representative body of the people. So I take it from that that the function of the legislature in the state and in the House of Representatives in the Congress, because the Senate doesn't represent the people as such, is to give or withhold the consent of the governed to legislation. And when we have the kinds of issues that are addressed in H.R. 1, voter suppression, excessive money in politics, gerrymandering, all of these undermine that fundamental concept in the functioning of the government as it is supposed to function on our behalf. So with that, let me introduce our Congressman, Mark Pocan. He's born and raised in Kenosha, received his BA in journalism from University of Wisconsin. He's the founder and perhaps still owner of Budget Signs. Served on our county board, served in Congress after Tammy Baldwin became our United States Senator for about 14 years, I guess. And then the last 6 years has served as our Congressperson in Washington, D.C. His abilities and capacity for leadership have been recognized by the leadership in the Congress with appointments to the Budget Committee, the Appropriations Committee, to serve as one of the whips for the Democratic Caucus, and also as chair or co-chair, I'm not sure, of the Progressive Caucus of the House Democrats. So with that, let me introduce Mark Pocan. Thank you.
I think I should grab that for more. You know, this issue, the issue that H.R. 1 is built on, really the fundamentals of our democracy, is an issue I think that's worth just taking a step back before I talk about the bill, and just a little bit about where we are and why the issue, I think, is especially relevant. One, as you all know, there's not much happening in Washington these days, right? Just kidding. Donald Trump, it's a very different environment, a place that we've quite honestly never experienced before. But I will give Donald Trump credit in one area. This particular issue area, he very adeptly noticed was an important issue to the American people. When he said, drain the swamp, that was probably one of the best single messages that came out of the last campaign, and is the same message, in my opinion, as what Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren say when they talk about the system being rigged, right? It is appealing to people thinking that they don't have the same say because of the power of special interests, which they're correct, that they have too much undue influence in Washington and Madison, and even at the local level in many ways, and they tied into that. So Donald Trump deserves credit for I guess, coining that phrase. Now, I will also say, when it comes to drain the swamp, he actually just, you know, dredged it a little deeper, put a high-rise luxury condo on it. So he didn't necessarily do what he said, but he deserves a lot of credit in the sense that he identified a problem that I think enough other people didn't identify. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, I think, have probably been the best as far as major figures nationally identifying it by saying the system is rigged. To me, that's a very similar message. But it shows is that people really get this. We understand that there is too much influence by special interests, and all too often we're not heard. So I wanted to start with that because I think that's really important in the context of anything we look at is that was across partisan lines. People realize and they feel this somewhat unbalance of power when it comes to legislation that passes and the influence that some have at all levels of government. So when we ran for the majority, when we were running last November, trying to get the majority for the House Democrats, we did polling, we talked to people, members sat down, and there were three major issues that we wound up running on. One was healthcare, and kind of even more specifically, the high cost of prescription drugs. Second was the need to help create better paying jobs, because jobs were starting to come back from 2008, largely thanks to President Obama, but wages were still a little behind, and part of that was tied to infrastructure, investing in infrastructure and creating those jobs through that. And then the third area was just that we needed to get our democracy back, that people felt that there was way too much of a culture of corruption in Washington, and we needed to address that. Those were the big three promises, and I can tell you from that was my third cycle running federally, the cycle before we were given a 16-point agenda to go back with, which is not pithy, memorable, or useful, to be perfectly honest. So I was happy to finally have, like, it narrowed down to three big issues. And this issue is so crucial to what we talked about and that we all believed in and crossed our various ideological divides, even within the Democratic Party, that it became H.R. 1, the very first bill that got a number and was introduced on behalf of the majority. Usually the first 10 bills are your priority bills you put out. We had some on gun violence prevention and healthcare and some other issues, but that was H.R. 1. So that was great progress, that not only did we see that that was what people were asking for across the country, we had just learned it from the last presidential, some of the issues around that, but that we were ready. And what happened? We took the majority back. With the great gerrymandering that's across the country, we still were able to flip enough seats that we took the majority with a decently comfortable margin. So when we came back in, we wanted to make sure that not only was this HR1, but that we had as strong a bill as possible. So there was a democracy reform task force formed that John Sarbanes from Maryland, who has been a longtime advocate on these issues, led, and a number of us were vice chairs. So I was one of the vice chairs on that. And we tried to figure out what we could all put in a bill. And then not only did we have what we could put in a bill, but then we had an amendment process on the floor where we added even more to the bill. But let me talk somewhat generally. I'll give you a few specifics. I think sometimes we can get lost in specifics, and I don't want to do that to you, but I'm more than willing to answer questions and discuss any of the other things, but I think just giving you a laundry list, you quite honestly can either read or know that, but let me kind of try to highlight, I think, what we tried to get done with it and what was especially relevant. So we wanted to, one, make it so that it was easier, not harder to vote. So there was an electoral reform component. There were three components. The second was we wanted to try to end the dominance of big money in our politics, and that was the campaign finance component. So electoral, campaign finance. And finally, we wanted tougher standards to fight corruption in politics, and that was the ethics reform. So election, campaign finance, and ethics reform were the three major pillars that we built this bill around. On voting rights, there's a few main areas. I'm just going to focus a little bit generally on this. One, we wanted to improve access to voting. So that was a number of different things that we did. Some of it was addressing early voting, making sure there's at least a certain amount of time that people could vote. Some of it was things like same-day registration, like we have in Wisconsin, and we wanted to make sure those kind of things were included. Some of it was making sure you couldn't limit voting hours or put too many other roadblocks in place, like we have seen all too often when we fight these state-by-state state, it's often like the game whack-a-mole, you know, the thing pops up and then you got one here. And you do that and you're always whack-a-moling, but you're never getting anything done. So we wanted to really kind of address those a little bit more holistic. We wanted to make sure that people had felony sentences could get their full rights restored, which again, in some states, it's a real patchwork. And you got to remember, when you talk about this, people always want to, you know, demagogue on this, right? And say, why should this child rapist be able to vote? But what you also have to remember is because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, there are people who received a dishonorable discharge simply for being gay or lesbian in the military. And in some states, that doesn't allow you to vote.
You're listening to Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan speaking on H.R. 1, which is the For the People Act of 2019, that calls to expand Americans' access to the ballot box, reduce the influence of big money in politics, and strengthen ethics rules for public servants and for other purposes. As of today, the bill has passed the House and is now with the Senate.
Right, so there's a full spectrum that's out there. So when they demagogue, just remember, I think we all do in this room, but it's often, you know, there's other reasons why you would address this, and you want to make sure that states aren't using this to try to have certain people vote and not others. We want to expand options by mail in early voting, and we want to modernize the voting system. And I'll get into a couple more specifics in a minute, but that's kind of the general categories we did in that area. The next one was around integrity, which was our ethics concerns. And I'm sorry, this is still on the election front. I'm sorry. We wanted to promote integrity by restoring the Voting Rights Act. Again, part of that whack-a-mole fight we've had in the states. We wanted to prohibit, and this is one of my specific provisions that I had added, the voter roll purges that we saw in Ohio and Georgia and other places, the interstate cross-check. You may have heard of where across states, if your name was Jose Gonzalez in Texas and you also showed up as a Jose, there's another Jose Gonzalez in Florida, which was probably many, to be perfectly honest, that was enough to have you thrown off both voting lists. That was that Chris Kobach, Kobach, am I saying that right, his last name? Pardon? Kobach, thank you. Yeah, isn't he running for something else right now too? I think the Senate or whatever. Anyway. That was what they wanted to do, is they wanted to get rid of certain voters. We stopped that practice. I had a separate bill, and that was rolled into this. We wanted to make sure that discriminatory voter ID laws, hello, Scott Walker, wouldn't happen. We wanted to end partisan gerrymandering, which I still think at the fundamental may be the single most important thing. If you want to restore your democracy, you've got to address gerrymandering. And we wanted to make it so that, again, your voice counted more. And then the last area was around security and in the voter section, in the election section, in that pillar. And we wanted to make sure that we had more federal support for voting system security, particularly, and again, one of my provisions of bill I had, paper ballots. And I got to tell you, if I can just do a quick aside, so often when issues come from back home, people wonder where some of the stuff comes from Washington. This is another one of those issues that has come from Wisconsin, kind of like the first bill ever introduced, we introduced in 2013 on refinancing student debt, because One Wisconsin Now did some work on this, and they had some amazing facts and figures that woke a lot of people up. We introduced a bill in 2013. The next year, someone else did. What was her name? Elizabeth Warren. And we got other people's attention, and now everyone understands the issue. That's an issue born from One Wisconsin Now. And I think the credit deserves there. Here, this is an issue that was borne by many folks locally advocating for paper ballots so that you have a verifiable receipt and some random auditing, all which we have added to the bill because it's important to have. So I just want to share that. Sometimes I think it's important to let folks know that the ideas that are created right here then wind up going there and not just going to Washington, but actually being introduced in the priority piece of legislation that we introduced in Congress. The second pillar on campaign finance, we had provisions to shine the light on dark money in politics by requiring any organization involved in political activity to disclose its large donors. Now, personally, I was the author of 100% public financing in the legislature. That's where I would go, but that's not where my whole caucus is. But the fact that we're getting to the point of getting this disclosure piece is an important piece to look at what's happening. We also wanted to make it so they couldn't hide their spending in other networks and in some ways around that. We specifically had empowering individuals the multiple matching system for small donations. So this was an area that was pretty controversial, but trying to find a way to have those kind of donations help empower folks and mean more than just the big dollars that come in from the outside. On oversight, we put in specific additional so-called campaign finance cops to make sure that laws on the books already were happening, and we wanted to tighten the rules on super PACs and restructure the Federal Election Commission so that we could try to address some of those issues. And then also Mitch McConnell had some riders that prevented government agencies from providing some of the information on campaign spending. We got rid of some of that. So again, I'm already starting to get into a little bit weedish, but I'm trying not, there's a whole lot of weeds. But I'm gonna give you some of the top rails the best I can. The final pillar was around ethics and accountability. And here, we really wanted to make it so that we could address some of the issues by expanding our conflict of interest laws and divestment requirements so that, you know, I know we all talk about the emoluments clause, obviously with the president. And most recently, did you see he was tweeting about his golf courses? Anyway, we wanted to slow the revolving door for members who then become lobbyists and get that taken care of. We wanted to prevent members of Congress from serving on corporate boards, and we wanted to require presidential candidates to show their tax returns. I guess we always thought that was maybe not a requirement, but a human instinct, but then we had Donald Trump. And that stopped. Also, we wanted to give teeth to the federal ethics oversight by overhauling the government of office ethics, closing some of the registration loopholes for lobbyists and foreign agents, and in some other provisions. And then we did have another provision of mine, too, that got added there. Actually, it was a Progressive Caucus. Well, the Progressive Caucus got the language on tax returns added. But then we had one, and this is a little weedy, but it's important because I have another committee I'm on right now on modernization. And again, we're using Wisconsin as the example of having a single portal to find out what lobbyists are up to, what they're spending their money on. Wisconsin's great. You go to the state site right now, and you can look up by issue, company, or lobbyist, and you know what's going on. And most states don't have that. And I've learned this very recently from talking to some experts that we had through modernization. Right now, federally, there's different portals for the executive branch, for the Senate, and the House, and even then, it's very convoluted, so it is really hard to track what any company is doing, and it, quite honestly, I think it was purposely created that way. And by having a single portal, every lobbyist essentially would have a unique number identifier, so no matter where they show up, there's a single place of contact, you can get that information. And that was also included there, and that's something that I thought was very important to have added. A couple other little provisions that I thought were important that we got added. We did get the interstate cross-check, the paper ballots, the single lobbying disclosure portal. To make sure that voting machines are made in America, we still have lots of concerns around the voting machines because, as we know from the Mueller report, which I'm going to talk about in just a second, but you know that they did try directly to hack into those companies as well. And then there's a practice of prison gerrymandering. So when you talk about gerrymandering, there's another thing where in some states what they've done is where they have prisons in very rural areas, they count those as that's your place for the census and for then how you're determining dollars and everything else, even they may have came of other bigger communities and maybe some higher poverty areas where that aid is really needed. And we wanted to stop that practice, and we had an amendment added to it around that too. So that was another provision that I thought was important. But that's just roughly the three pillars, some of the stuff we addressed in each pillar and tried to look at. What's happened is we've sent this to the Senate. And what is happening right now with Mitch McConnell is this is the place things go to die. Think of like a big gravestone. That's what Mitch McConnell's doing. They're buried somewhere in Kentucky in the backyard of someone's house. And all they're really doing, if you ask any senator from Tammy, who I love, to other ones I fly with various times, they'll tell you all they're doing is confirming conservative judges. There's little else that's getting through the Senate. So we have sent a lot of good bills, including this bill. So what we did is we sent another bill to specifically address the concerns from the Mueller report. And that was HR, I gotta look down because I'm terrible at the numbers, 2722, which I can give you a real rough idea, but I don't know if the details are extremely important, but it's called the SAFE Act. that gets just at issues like paper ballots, American-made machines, some of the critical stuff that we saw in the report. And then let me wrap with this, because I really want to take your questions, the Mueller report and how it relates to this, because pretty much anywhere I go, the Mueller report comes up. I think this audience might be different than others, but I'm going to ask anyway. How many of you have read the full, and I'm going to emphasize the word full, Mueller report? All right. You just doubled the number of people I have had cumulatively who've answered that question. So I thought that would be the answer here. Thank you for confirming.
12 bucks.
There you go. But it is not exactly the kind of read you do at a beach with a piña colada, right? This is a read that, you know, it's not complicated to read, but there's a lot. You got to go down and look at footnotes. You got to go through redacting and figure out how you connect two paragraphs with a page in between missing. And there's a reason why most people haven't read it, which is one of the main reasons why we're trying to get witnesses to actually come to committees like Judiciary Intelligence and tell us what's in it. And that's why Donald Trump, who keeps saying the report says he's innocent, says no witness can come and talk to us. Now, I live by the Wisconsin smell test. If I was Donald Trump and I was that innocent and the report said that, I would give these people a ride to the hearing. I'd give them a big bottle of water so their voice is really clear so that they can sing how innocent he is. But that's not what's happening. So he fails on my basic test of reliability. But the first 180 pages of that report, the two sections, talks about Russian interference. And you may remember one of my favorite again, interesting lines with this administration that we never experienced before is Mr. Kushner, the president's son-in-law, when he said that the Mueller report was worse on the country than what Russia did in our elections, and it was just a few Facebook ads. This is 180 pages of them hacking into elected officials who run election operations, hacking into companies that make voting machines. Organizing rallies around the country on specific issues to create discontent around the country via Facebook and Twitter and other social media. I mean, this is a very organized, serious effort that happened. And specifically then, we sent this bill hoping that maybe that at least take something that would be country over party and put that forward, and then we're going to break up HR 1 into other pieces and send those forward as well, trying to see what we can get done. But right now, Mitch McConnell truly is just burying stuff in some backyard in Kentucky, and we're not seeing it. And it's going to be very difficult without that public pressure to happen. So I think what you're going to see is we got two more weeks. We're in for July. Everyone goes home for the August in-district period. I think that's where we're going to try to have a lot of activities around the country, especially for some of these senators on the Republican side that are, you know, enabling this nothing moving through the Senate. But it's really important that we get there. So I think with that, I'm going to end my part of the presentation. I'd really much rather try to answer your questions. I just ask, please, no hard math. You know, I'll try not to get, you know, some of the specifics, the weeds are really hard, because I'll be honest, we did this early, HR 1, and since then we've done five more months of other things. We just did the NDAA, which had hundreds of amendments. I just finished the appropriations process, so I'm a little rusty on the exact, you know, deep into the particulars. But I'd love to talk to you about, you know, the general issue. If there are other things you think you should address, if you want to take up some other subjects, I'm more than willing to. And again, I really want to thank you for coming out on a beautiful Saturday morning.
You're listening to Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan speaking on HR 1, which is the For the People Act of 2019, that calls to expand Americans' access to the ballot box, reduce the influence of big money in politics, and strengthen ethics rules for public servants and for other purposes. And now, a discussion with the audience.
Really open it up for any questions people have. I see lots of hands already. So I'll tell you, I'll go back and forth. How's that sound? So we'll start right here. Thanks for coming. Youth here, look at this.
My question was one of kind of...
So let me answer it in a couple ways, because you kind of have a couple things, although I agree with you, they're all related. Like, what is the... And again, I don't think individually any one of these is the silver bullet, right? One, you can't have any country interfere with our elections, right? And that's kind of the first part of the Mueller report we're trying to address. You would think at minimum, if you had a somewhat functioning Congress, that you would get together around that and it'd be country over party and you'd be able to address that. The problem is, as you read the Mueller report, one of Donald Trump's big fears was that he would that people would think his election was illegitimate because of what happened and because he is such a narcissist and, you know, down the list of terms that you can, you know, call it, he couldn't handle that. So they, you read it and they're even the senior staff aren't allowed to even bring up Russia because it affects him. So how could you have a 90-minute phone call with Vladimir Putin and never bring up that issue? Or then we saw when he had the little sit-down recently, and the best he could go is, yes, don't mess around our elections, right? Like, it was just demeaning how he handled it. So this isn't a just go after Russia thing, but it is a, you can't have any country or any entity try to hack into our elections and do that. So I still think there is a potential that we can get some of these things done in that area, because at some point, I mean, we do have to have more people rise above the party. And one of the good things out of the Mueller report, I feel like I'm selling the Mueller report as I keep talking to y'all, but is there are some people who worked for the Trump administration who really were there for country over Donald Trump. So as much as the Republican Party seems to appear these days to be a cult around Donald Trump, there were good people who went there and actually defied orders he gave that probably kept him out of jail, but that cared about the country more than Donald Trump. So we do have to address that, and I think that legislation, there's still a separate path to get done. The harder legislation is around money in politics, because if you think about it, if someone got elected on the current system, they're not really, their first priority often is not to change the system that they got elected by, right? And so that alone is the biggest problem. So that's why I always thought 100% public finance, like at the state level when I was a legislator, if you took out all that influence, you could do it. One thing I don't think a lot of you know, and I'm going to ask you if you knew this afterwards, but I was really inspired. We had 36 freshmen get elected this year without taking any corporate PAC money. Previously, there were 5 people in the House of Representatives that didn't take corporate PAC money, and 36 people in the last class got elected. So that's interesting statistic number one. I was inspired by that, and even though I didn't get a lot of the corporate money that a lot of other people get, we decided to no longer take corporate money at all either. So we officially are now part of that group, along with a couple other people like I joined into that. So now we've got about 10% of Congress, that's of the 435, that no longer take it. It already is having an impact. When people got onto financial services, there's a really good book right now called, I think it's called We've Got People, but Ryan Grimm, who's a writer for The Intercept, and I'm about 2/3 of the way through it, and it's one of my favorite books I've read recently on politics, because he does a great job of chapters about some of the key moments in recent history, what happened around the banking laws and other stuff from his observation as a journalist. He has a great chapter on the banking bill, and talking about how some of the senior people on financial services were often more progressive than the junior members, the lower, because there's 4 tiers of how you sit. And it's because the newer people who often got to that committee were there because you could fundraise off of Wall Street by being on that committee. And that's why people took it. When people don't take corporate money, guess what? They suddenly don't want to be on financial services, yet it's a really important committee. So we had Maxine Waters of the Progressive Caucus had to go around and lobby our friends like AOC and Katie Porter, although Katie Porter, to be fair, always wanted to be on it, but a few others to say, this is a great committee, we need you to go on it for these reasons. And I'm so glad they did, and they're happy because we need good people on it. But that's traditionally been a committee that those folks would go to, but suddenly now we had this problem to convince people to go on a committee, which is a good problem. So it's a baby step, but at least we're seeing that move forward. But all the more why we've got to address campaign finance, even if it's dark money disclosure, you know, you should at least know who, you know, whatever group with a nice sounding name that money is actually coming from. I think it's called We've Got People, but the author is Ryan Grimm, G-R-I-M. I think there's one M in his name. He writes for The Intercept. And it's my right now my plane reading book. So as I'm going back and forth, but I'm finding it, you know, I don't even want to put it down when I land, because it's really interesting how he's writing these little chapters with some really good insight from some of the people that were involved that I haven't read before. Like, I didn't know David Sirota on Bernie's staff, who's like his main communications guy, used to work for Dave Obey from Wisconsin. Little things like that I'm finding as I read through it, so it's a good read. But I've answered a little long, but I do think they're separate. I mean, we're trying to address them all in that one bill, but obviously Mitch McConnell's not going to pass that one bill. It doesn't mean you don't continue to push on every one of those three fronts. And I wouldn't say that one trumps the other, no pun intended. I think that it's, you know, we need to, on a parallel track, be addressing campaign finance and some of the ethical issues from the Emoluments Clause, all the other stuff, you know, that's happening, as well as the election stuff. And I think we can do it at the same time, the walking and chewing gum. So, okay, let me go to this side, right here. So, and one of the things I said in the beginning, I do think, to me, gerrymandering may be like the very top issue to me when it comes to democracy reform, more than pretty much anything, because when, right now in Congress, just as an example, I would argue there's probably 20 to maybe in a really, really, really good election cycle, 25% of the seats in Congress are actually competitive that could be picked up by one party or another. So what happens out of that is you have blue seats and you have red seats, and because the Republicans have a Tea Party element, even though primary turnout is always lower by every party, whenever you have a primary election, when you take that Tea Party percent, it like doubles in those primaries, and that's what happens. You get a six-way Republican primary, and someone can win with 10,000 votes in a congressional primary, and they're the next member of Congress because it's a one-party district, and you've elected someone who is extreme by every standard, especially the 2010 standards where a lot of these folks came in. So I still think that in many ways that issue, for me, becomes a real paramount issue because it affects how we do then getting rid of NCIC United, how we do other things to move towards a public financing system, how you deal with ethics issues and all the rest. Now, I love the United to Amend, Move to Amend around the country and those forces because I think it's great to show the votes from the grassroots. Normally, in a rational environment, that would be very, very persuasive, but it's not because of the gerrymandering, right? The Republicans know they don't have to listen because it is right now impossible to pick up the House of Representatives, the state legislature, the assembly in Wisconsin. We got 53-54% of the vote, and we got 36% of the seats in the last election. They know that because of it. So we really do have to address that. So I kind of put gerrymandering kind of at a little higher tier because I think if we address that, that helps. But I also will say it goes down to elections. You know, at the end of the day, when you can, even with the gerrymandering, like we did in the House of Representatives, flip 30-some seats enough to take the majority, that was a significant thing because I was told if that had not been from gerrymandering, it probably would have been a 60-70 seat swing we would have had in a normal cycle. It would have been that much bigger, and you could have actually done a lot more because right now, trust me, I'm butting my heads up every now and then, even though we have a 17-seat majority, I've got probably a couple dozen people at any given time who would rather spend their time rocking in a fetal position in the corner of a room than passing legislation. So. You know, so I think the electoral process is really, really important. Gerrymandering and addressing that is really, really important, and that's going to help us get to some of this. But I think these ballot measures are extremely valuable because, as you just said, the lowest percent you got was 61%. That's an amazing point to be able to have out there. But we've got to address a couple of the other fundamentals, I think, to help along the way. So what we have to remember is, in 2016, we had a drop off of 200 to 250,000 Democratic voters in Wisconsin, and because of it, Donald Trump won. And elections have consequences. That first year, I said it every day, and I'm glad I don't have to say it every day anymore. I think people really understand it. And to Madison specifically in the district in the last gubernatorial election, when Madison had 93% turnout. I like to say that to my colleagues and watch their mouth open because no one's ever heard of 93% turnout anywhere, and yet we're getting that part down here. We just have to continue to get that. And I do think as I look at my congressional district and even going a little bit west, the next two counties, we've been doing better and better in these areas. And some of it might be Madison population, some of it might be outreach and all the rest. But it really is a grassroots game. It's having person-to-person conversations. It's not ads on TV. It's knocking on doors. It's field. It's those sorts of things. And I think if we do that more and have those conversations, we'll get farther. It's not giving you the immediate answer you want. Unfortunately, nothing is immediate. but hopefully it's given my at least best take on how we can address it. So go ahead. Yeah, I mean, so there are some things. This is an interesting area where sometimes the left and the right meet in Washington. Like, we're a lot of the folks that don't want to have, you know, some of the FISA laws and things that are in place. We often vote with it's not so much the Tea Party, but there's another caucus. I forget what they call themselves. But is it the Freedom? Well, Freedom is the Tea Party, right? There's another caucus. I forget what they're calling themselves offhand. But we often are hand in hand with them, and we get the votes. And quite honestly, the people who are opposing us are both the Republican and Democratic leadership. We seem to be a little more bought into some of the expansive use of this. But our votes have been really close. In fact, recently, in the last couple of years, even under Republican control, we had a few votes that were like 210 we lost by, and you need 218. So we're getting very close to that, but I just think it's another one of those issues you got to keep asking people about on election time, keep trying to make people aware of, like you're doing by raising it now. And I think it's important in that sense. The other thing is, you know, we had a week this week on the National Defense Authorization, and it was difficult in the sense that we had a lot of good progressive amendments that were added around trying to make sure we don't have a war in Iran, trying to have a commission look at how to reduce spending in the future. I mean, a cast of provisions. But at the end of the day, I was one of the lone eight Democrats to vote against the bill. We had a number, top number for defense, of $733 billion. And just fiscal year 17, not that long ago, the last, I think it's the last session that Barack Obama was around, that number was 618. So that's almost a 20% increase in just three fiscal years around defense spending. And so I voted against it, just said I was very upfront with the person who's the chair of the Armed Services Committee. I'm like, look, that number is just way, way too high. The priorities within it, we've got issues. We try to get some of the votes, and we lost on a few of those. But that's another area, too, I would add, in addition to intelligence, that I think we got to get a bit of better grasp on. Sure. So let me answer. You have actually a lot in there, and a lot of really good, valid points that I'm dealing with every single day when I'm out there. So I appreciate your comments. And you know, I love being the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus of Pramila Jayapal. We're 40% of the Democrats. And we've got some ability to do things. HR 1, we added a whole bunch that was really good because of our caucus. The DREAM Act, we added a whole bunch. A couple weeks ago, we had some really great things put into the border supplemental to protect kids so that no matter if you're in a private or a public facility, you had to live up to the FLORES agreements. FLORES agreement is the standard so that you don't have kids in squalor and all the rest. And we had a hammer added that a contractor could lose their contract when they're making $750 a day to house the kids that they don't have soap and toothpaste and all the rest for. I mean, all this stuff. And we passed it, the Democratic caucus, because they couldn't pass it till we put our provisions in. And to be fair, Nancy Pelosi had our backs on that. We had a group of corporate Dems in a group called Problem Solvers that ultimately said they were going to vote against the rule to allow the bill to come up. And a few other things happened. And make a long story short, we wound up just passing what the Senate had, which was funding. But funding wasn't the issue. If they got to look at Donald Trump for morals and values, right? I mean, that's what they're doing right now. They know they can get away with anything because Donald Trump is the guy in charge in his administration. So, but we've had a lot of good successes, and we're putting these ideas out there, and we're showing what we can do, especially, hopefully, with a different president in just another year or so, what we can get done. I do want to clear one thing up, because this comes up a lot of different things. So the DNC, other than the fact that it's in the same building as the DCCC and the Senate Campaign Committee, there's like no relationship between the three. And I just want to, it helps for people to understand. So the DNC, kind of the national party, works with the state party, works with the local parties, but it's always removed a little more as you get, you know, more localized on it. The DTRIP is kind of the campaign arm of the House Democrats, as the Senate is the arm of the Senate Democrats. I have some issues right now with our leadership on the DCCC because we're saying that any vendor that works for a candidate running against an incumbent will be blackballed. I think is an awful, awful idea. And we were, I think as the first or, no, I think the second, one of the persons spoke out first. And then, and we're still trying to get them to change that policy. And those are the things that they're not listening to us about, right? I mean, that's not something that we want, because we don't want to be picking who are the only people who can run for office. I mean, people like AOC. In fact, what's interesting, most of the New York delegation had to beat out an incumbent somewhere to get where they're at now. And now they want to keep the rules for themselves, and they don't want to change it. So we're fighting to keep that as democratic with a small d as possible along the way. So we are trying to send that message. But it is a fight. I mean, we have 17, I think it is, seat margin in the House, which generally would be fine. But this session, we've had a weird phenomena where some of our freshmen who came in from some of these tougher purple to red even districts are a little afraid, and they're getting some bad advice maybe from our campaign committee on how to vote, and sometimes we're having to be pretty tough. So I've been sending texts this morning with Pramila Jayapal about next week we're taking minimum wage up, and it looks like there's going to be a little change to it that we don't love, but at the same time it's not enough to derail the bill. But we're trying to have some of our partners maybe start helping us beef up a little bit of spine for some of these folks that get afraid so easy. And we're working on that. So, but that happens because of, honestly, you all and people across the country, people like you reaching out and saying this to other, you know, to elected officials. You know, groups like Indivisible, I think, is the breakout group of the resistance, because it is truly grassroots grown across the country. And yet at the same time, we can get information out to people, and they can, about bills that are coming up and other things. When people call and put the pressure on, we're more successful inside when we have an inside-outside strategy and are able to work that way. So that's what we've done with the Progressive Caucus, trying to get that done. I don't know if I gave you a full answer, but I hope I gave you enough background. But I did want to just do a little distinction, because all too often I kind of get people, you know, DNC really has nothing to do with the DTRIP other than we're housed in the same building. So I don't want to have either group have to live by the other group's actions. Secure elections in Wisconsin, given example of Sauk County where someone tried to hack in, supposedly didn't get through, but how it, so it's harder at a state level than a federal level, because federal level, we have certain national critical infrastructure definition that you have financial institutions under, and you have the energy grid under. If you had the elections under, that provides some extra securities that makes it harder to hack, and there's actually federal resources to do that. I suppose you could try to do that at the state level, but I don't know if I see Senator Fitzgerald rising to that challenge. How's that the most polite way of saying that I could have possibly said? So I think it would be difficult for him in that way to be able to do it. I do think, though, that I really think somehow the at least heart of that 27-22, because it's really, that's just trying to get towards some of those issues around Russia, can happen. What I've really learned on the federal level is we can pass lots of bills, but if they don't go through both houses and get signed, it's not going to get there. But if there's a way to put them on a must-pass piece of legislation, and there are several, including the appropriations process and national defense authorization, other things like that, you can maybe get it done. And I'm hoping that we're probably going to wind up with a continuing resolution, I'm guessing, this year, even though the House, we've done all our work. We've done, I think, 11 of the 12 appropriation bills. Senate won't even take them up yet, any of them, and our fiscal year ends September 30th. We're in for 2 weeks. We're gone. We come back the second week of September. I can already write the end to the story. So there's some vehicles still that we could try to get that done and provide some assistance. And I really, really want to believe that that is something we still can rise to. There are Republicans, including in the House of Representatives, who know better on this and will say that fairly openly, and so I'm hoping that we'll still have a vehicle to do that, but I think it's hard for Governor Evers to do it single-handedly. The F-35s coming to Wisconsin, and I would answer, I've never voted for funding for it. In fact, just recently, I just got explaining, I was one of eight Democrats, the squad, myself, Earl Blumenauer, Adriano Espelot, and Barbara Lee, who voted against the defense budget. So, having said that, I do want to address, I think that what you really are kind of asking is the National Guard here was losing the current plane that they have here, and you'd have lost the jobs and the infrastructure that was there. The F-35 was going to go somewhere in the country, and they were vying for it. And if it's going to go to Texas or Florida, I didn't have a problem with it coming to Wisconsin, so I will say that. But I have not supported it, and I'm not sure if the F-35 is even the right plane or anything else, and that's a whole separate question, which is why on the budget Terry side. I don't support the level. There's a lot of programs within it I would love to change. One of the things, if I can, just a quick aside on it, but I think it's relevant. Pramila Jayapal, who's my co-chair, who's from Seattle, who's an amazing member, and you should follow her because she's so good to work with as a co-chair. I've watched other teams where they don't always work completely in sync, and we really do. She was been fighting for, and we have an amendment that does it, but more importantly, we're working on this separately with a commitment from Leader Pelosi to form a commission to try to identify cuts to defense, and I think there's going to be some kind of a target to it of dollars. And out of that, we're telling them already for the next year at NDAA, we expect, because this commission has been agreed to put together, that we better see those cuts show up. Because when you have 733, and where the Senate passed, I think, 750, and that's what the president now says he wants, when we were at 618 just three cycles ago, that's a 20% increase. That's crazy where it's going. I will tell you, in a private meeting, and I'm going to paraphrase, because I got to be a little careful how I say this, someone who's in the defense appropriations area, when they first got that number, they actually said, I don't even know how we'll spend that much money. Like this is, but the problem is the defense industry, because they often have contractors everywhere in the country, it's a way that they get members to often support the jobs associated with it, which is why we have a problem on it. But that commission puts, I think, a marker out for the next year that maybe we could actually finally scale that number back. So I'm hoping that'll happen. But I just wanted I've never voted for any funding for the F-35, and I haven't voted for an NDAA yet since I've been in Congress. And this one was tough because we got lots and lots of arm twisting, which is why a lot of other good people said, well, I had a good amendment in there, so I'm going to vote for it. I said, I don't care. I have one amendment I asked them to put in. I'm not going to try to put a bunch of other things in and tell you I'm going to vote against it because at the end of the day, 733 is way too big of a number. I'll just wrap up and just say, you know, thanks so much again for coming out. Other thing that we didn't really talk about, but if you ever need anything, we can help you. We do kind of have, for those who remember Batman, the bat phone, you know, to the agencies, and we can help people navigate stuff, and we do that often on Veterans Affairs and IRS and your passport, anything else. And again, Fred, thank you so much for having me this morning. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan speaking on H.R. 1, which is For the People Act of 2019. It is a bill that calls to expand Americans' access to the ballot box, reduce the influence of big money in politics, and strengthen ethics rules for public servants and for other purposes. As of today, the bill has passed the House and is now with the Senate. Mark Pocan spoke at the Sequoia Public Library on July 13, 2019. The talk was sponsored by the Madison Institute, the League of Women Voters of Dane County, American Constitution Society, Common Cause in Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. You can find other thought-provoking programs at the Madison Institute's website at themadisoninstitute.org.